Okay. First, quickly, today's topic, we're going to continue a bit with the same themes with Juha-Pekka, who visited us last week. He mainly discussed about domain-specific modeling, but it's my perception these are the two main keywords he spoke about. It's domain-specific modeling, it's one way to do reuse and automation. And we're going to take a look at these on a bit more general level from a few different viewpoints in this lecture. But now, first, I quickly go through again this assignment three, a couple of tips if you haven't done yet. So the deadline is early next week, is it? Yes. So try to find an article, and the important keyword is a case study, scientific article, a case study. Google, if you don't know yet what it means, you need it for your master's thesis, at least, if you didn't need it yet. Important keyword, a case study. And it speaks about automation from some viewpoint in software engineering. So, just clarification. One mistake many of you made with the first assignment that caused some confusion. You didn't read the full assignment. You took the first phrase in the assignment, took the keywords there, did the Google search, and it gave you a bit confusing results. Same. It's not exactly the same here, but just my one tip. Automation and software engineering are not good Google search words for this. For a couple of reasons. You get two kind of results typically. Many of the results relate to software engineering in different automation systems, which is completely a different thing. Now we talk about automation in software engineering practices. It's a different thing than developing software for automation. So that's one side note there. The second thing is that, especially if you search with keywords automation and software engineering, simply many of the results, and including one important journal in the field, includes mainly very technical research. Overall, this the mainstream in the research is different technical solutions to the topic, and very very narrow scope, like different new methods to generate test cases in test automation, and so very narrow. And so it's fine for me if you don't want to read such paper, but it's just my guess that most of you want to focus on some more less technical issues. So pay some attention in selecting the proper paper for you that fits into your interest. So that's why a case study that probably doesn't describe only the technical solution in that specific case organization for automation. You find a lot of that kind of papers, but I think it's better for most of you if you find such case study that focus more on general experiences, challenges in the organization, in the adoption, success factors, whatever. That kind of more general management kind of issues. Is this clear? Something to ask? Okay. Again, about some other practical things in the course. Are you still following me? Everything's clear. Okay, that's good. Now we can get into the business for today. It's we have two lectures left, this course, after this. Now we still focus on this, and then we're going to discuss about global software engineering issues, and possibly we have a visitor in the last lecture again, but I'm not sure yet to take a look at some very current issues today and possibly tomorrow in the software engineering. But let's see. I'm going through again a few basic things from the last lecture. This is one of the Juha Pekka slides in the beginning of the last lecture. So the terminology is a bit confusing sometimes. It's mixed. There are many different terms when speaking about modeling or model-driven development, that the last lecture was about. And we can't go to the details, and the use of the different terms are a bit mixed. A couple of points here, like in your papers, in the middle, model-driven architecture, Juha Pekka briefly explained this last time. It's a specific trademark, as put there, specific approach standardized by, is it object management group or whatever the organization is? It's a specific approach for model-driven development. Sometimes when you read a paper about model-driven development, it means this. Model-driven architecture is the exact term for that. Or in many times, model-driven development, or in one of your course readings, in the title is model-driven engineering. That's kind of umbrella term for different kind of model-driven, similar kind of things. Like it in that paper, it includes both this model-driven architecture kind of thing and domain-specific modeling, which is a bit different thing, and so on. So don't get confused. You must understand something about it. Model-driven development overall, it's important to understand what it generally means as an umbrella term. Model-driven architecture, we don't go to the details there, but it's a specific, I think, domain-specific modeling. Last time you had a full lecture, almost full lecture about that specifically. Then a couple of things. When you go and read the papers, you have a couple of papers in the course readings about this. Some things you should understand. Basic concepts of modeling, meta-modeling. That should be clear already if you listened to Juha Pekka last time. So don't get confused. It's not, you just have to understand the terms. It's not so complex. But if you don't understand the basic terminology, you are very confused in reading the course readings, the papers. So if you get confused, listen again some parts of the Juha Pekka's lecture last time. He gave good input, brief explanation for those. Okay, I explained model-driven development engineering. They sometimes, in some papers, they are synonyms. In your course readings, they are not. Okay, one thing which is mixed, it's possibly not so easy to explain briefly, but domain-specific language, it's more general term. It may mean, in the research, when you read the papers, two different things. Language is a more general term. It may relate to modeling language. When we speak about modeling language, we usually refer to drawing some graph, like Juha Pekka showed you last time. For example, UML graph is a graph. When we talk about modeling, we mean that. Draw a graph, a picture. But language in some other papers mean written language, like program code. So when Juha-Pekka last time spoke about domain-specific modeling, or in more compact form, domain-specific language, in his context, this language means that notation of the graph. In some papers you read, and these sometimes get mixed in the papers, this domain-specific language means some written text language, like instead of some general Java code, you create an own language in which you can do some big things in a couple of words. The same idea than that Juha-Pekka told about that modeling last time. But you just don't draw the graph, but write really short impression in text form. Yeah. I don't know if you remember this when you read the papers, but sometimes this is important to separate. So, and sometimes the use is mixed in the papers, and if you read some literature review in the field, they may include different kind of studies that speak actually about a bit different things. Most of the things when you in this phenomenon is common, but that makes the a bit use of the language a bit different. So it's usually still some programmer who use domain-specific language if it's still written code, even if it's very short code. But when you do this kind of language, which is graph, modeling language, which Juha-Pekka told about, at least the possible users are different. But okay, let's get forward. I think this is clear enough or not. Just briefly about this model-driven development, which in this means, okay, this is Mauri Leppänen's slide from 2 years ago in the same course. Just simplified explanation. Juha-Pekka told this last time a bit different words. This means specifically that model-driven architecture now. Now this is kind of synonym for that. So how it happens in this model, the key difference which Juha-Pekka compared last time is that in this approach, the key idea is to use some general tools, like UML graphs. We take general tool like UML and find a way to end up with full code generation in the end. And what we have to do if we have this kind of general tool is different layers of generation. We create a general level graph, then there is some transformation tool. I never have done this practice myself. I don't know the details, don't ask. But just the general idea. Then we add some details, then we run a new transformation and get more specific graph. And finally, in the end, you may do this several times, and then in the end, you probably generate a full code. So the main idea is the same, that just by drawing some graphs or setting some parameters there, you end up with full code in the best case. But in this, you have to do that several times if you use these kind of standard tools like UML. What is this? Okay. Juha-Pekka went through this. Okay, this difference in his picture was in the right. This modern-driven architecture, second from the right, is this. You make the model run transformation to more specific model, add some details, run the transformation again, and then you get code and the product. This domain-specific modeling meant that you add the details in the modeling language. So, like, Juha-Pekka gave examples of fish farm or polar heart rate monitors. And so the difference is you write all the details in the language and code generators after that, and then all that is needed is to draw one model, one graph, okay, in some size of the product you may have different models, but anyway, the simple version is this. You don't have different level of models, but like in this model-driven architecture, but just one model, and then you pass the button and you get the code. That's in the simplest version, that's the idea. And again, to repeat in a bit different words, I want this clear. The initiation of all this is reuse and automation, like I started today. So you have something you have done before. That's requirement for this. Not absolute requirement. You can start from grads, but usually that's not a good idea. You have some experience to do something for a few times, and then you try to think what kind of parts you could automate in the system. Like in the last lecture, that fish farm was an obvious example. It was a company that develops software to automate fish farms. So there are so many, all the fish farms are different, but the system that is used for automation have everywhere the same components. So you have a lot of common, but just the configuration is a bit different and you have to modify a bit for different farms depending how many ponds they have and what kind of automation they have in that specific case or such like things. Okay, that makes sense. You have these kind of commonalities, and then so you define them, then you define that domain-specific modeling language. One of the idea from the communication point of view is to put there some descriptive pictures and something like that. That gives a good idea of the domain. And you create some rules there. Okay, there are, listen again yesterday. I'm not going to go through the whole thing again. Just the basic idea. You create the language, the notation, then you create the rules there, then you do the code generator. And okay, maybe that's enough for that. Okay, again. Okay, let's stop here for a minute. Again, Juha-Pekka showed you this slide. about productivity. This was his reasoning for this whole domain-specific modeling thing. There is some already pretty old graph about... Okay, that it says that it tells you how many features can be implemented in a given time with different kind of languages. That's the general term here. And what is the productivity increase if you have this kind of domain-specific language in use compared to these more general tools? So my questions now, I want you to stop thinking a bit. Based on last time lecture, a quick revision here, my questions, why? Okay, this is not tricky. There are some obvious reasons, but I want you to think about it a bit. Okay, why this productivity increase? And the second question, that might be a bit more difficult. Do you have some doubts about it? And some reasons, please. Okay, you can take a minute. You can discuss with your friend. With this domain-specific language, high productivity increase. Why? Do you have some doubts about this? Okay, some opinions here. So why this is maybe true? The why question. Why this kind of productivity increase with domain-specific languages? Okay, this wasn't a hard question. So, anyone? Okay. One tip I used two main keywords when I started this lecture. Okay, there are more details, but that's fine for us. Here it's about reuse and automation. Okay, naturally, you get some increase. That's the main idea of the whole thing. but it impress. So, but what about the second question? Do you have some doubts about this? Some counter arguments? What? Yeah. Yeah, but I suppose the idea is to compare if you do the same functionality. It's with different approaches. And okay. Everyone buys this like that. No arguments. Okay, let's not use much time for this. Couple of things first come to my mind here. Okay, first, I don't know the original data. I don't know where this comes from. But just when I look at the scale, that makes me doubt about the difference, actually. It's my guess is that this is not fair comparison for a couple of different reasons. I believe you get some high value if you are able to make a good use case for domain-specific languages. I don't doubt this generally, but just the difference. I doubt that this comparison is fair for two reasons. You can do automation and reuse in Java language and implement that kind of framework yourself in Java. So it's not fair comparison if you have done all the automation and then do some single project starting from scratch with Java, or if you already have some huge code generators in domain-specific language. It's not a fair comparison. But even if you had some, I believe that there is a difference even if you had the same libraries, whatever, already in Java written there, and you make reuse in the project with Java compared to this kind of domain-specific day. It's, I think doing its domain-specific way might be more, I'm sure it's more effective anyway, if you implement it well. Okay, the second thing is this, and there is a difference in investment. If in domain-specific world, there is an investment before you can do the project. Remarkable investment in creating the tools and languages and so on. Java tools you can buy off the shelf with very small investment. They are general, everybody knows that in the field and so on. So that's, so again, I don't, just some general ideas. I don't know the original data and where the numbers come from and so on. And again, this is a bit old, but some general thinking on this all, it was the idea. And one thing again, what it means. In this domain-specific modeling, you create a language and code generators. That's one part. Sometimes you may call it platform. It's sometimes product lines. We discuss a bit about product lines on more general level today, something like that. But that's one part of the investment. The main investment, then you need tools. You need to create the language. You need to create code generators, that whole platform, to enable that automatization. Then that modeling here means that one single project. When you have that language and generators there, and you create a single product on base of that. You, in a simple version, if you have perfect generators, Juha-Pekka told yesterday, and it's referred in several papers, that in real cases you usually don't. That's why there is that manual tailoring part. So you get in practice some part of the code from this automatic code generators, and then you do some manual programming to finish the product. That's the typical. So kind of three parts. If we think about costs for this, there is this investment. Okay, it starts, by the way, with adoption. We could think about adoption costs, like with any kind of method, new approach, organizational improvement, whatever. We can think about these general things. We need to have proper skills. We need to have right tools there. We need some new way of thinking. That takes some time. We have to train people, and so on. It creates some basis for the adoption costs. And if we think this as an investment. Okay, that's the first part. But the technical part of the investment is creating the language and code generators. Then in each single project or product, whatever they call it, depending on the business, we do this modeling. Then it takes some time. And I think the process regardless of the actual implementation can be pretty much similar as in any software development. You need to have requirements for the single project or product we are developing. We just how to implement it in practice. We draw the graph, set the rules there, set some parameters. We need there, pass the button, we get the code, but the code is not perfect. We have to do some programming manually to get the end product. So when we evaluate the costs and benefits of this all, we have to do some calculation based on this all. So what is the actual investment overall, and what is the effectiveness, a difference in effectiveness for a single product or project? What is the needed time and effort for that modeling and manual tailoring part? And all this depends. So it's easy to see that the more you have similar kind of products, the more you have common in them, the more effective is, and the more, and that depends on how many times you use the same thing, of course. Okay, nothing special here. Just last of this, this is of your course readings, so it's just few points there. So model-driven engineering was the umbrella term in that paper, which is in your course readings. And in their study, most of the users of this kind of model-driven engineering paradigm, and they used this domain-specific, some kind of domain-specific languages. So second point, in those cases, productivity increase was between 20-30% in most of the companies. I'm not going to continue with that now, but you can compare that to what Juha-Pekka told last week, or what is written in their paper, which is, again, in the course readings, the other paper of this topic in the course readings. Okay, they give some strong reasoning for their, obviously, their own tool and way to to do the things with their own soul, and their reasoning is that with a proper approach and proper tooling, you can get much higher increase in productivity. It's more like, in their papers, it's more like hundreds of percentage than dozens, like in here. But you can be a bit critical, but read the reasoning in the paper. Okay, general finding, adoption in this may take a long time, and it's compared to typical agile adoption. These are perceptions from industry who have used this kind of approach. And I think it's believable. It's you can do agile with some kind of agile, and it's believable, but it's easier to understand. It's a main shift if you do organizational change, organization-wide, from traditional development to agile. But in this kind of production, this needs heavy change in the whole thinking, also in the development level. There are several technical issues, and developers there at grassroots level must adopt a new way of thinking. And so I think that's, for those reasons, that's believable for me, that it may take longer time to adopt this kind of thinking in the development organization. Okay, and basically for that reason also, because the technical things are so important here, and the new way of thinking relates more to the technical level also, it's especially important. Okay, you read it in every paper that it's important to have management support for your improvement, but here especially you need developers in. They have to buy the idea. Okay, general things, it's kind of new approach, new skills are needed there. You need a different kind of thinking, and some of the new thinking depends on the perspective is a bit different. So if you do this kind of development effectively, you must keep the big picture in mind all the time. When you develop software, you can't focus on the small details only to do the software quick and fast for the customer. You must keep the big picture in mind to gain the benefits of reuse. And of course, you need kind of new kind of expertise with these tools, meta-modeling ideas, and such like things. It's a bit different from writing code. Okay, well, one of the findings in that paper is that in many cases that gain productivity increase wasn't the main driver for the whole improvement when they implemented this kind of model-driven approaches. They perceived that it supported good architecture in many ways. And that productivity increase is the way to sell it to the management, obviously, but there are many good side effects that comes with this kind of development style. That was one of the perceived benefits there. Finally, this was a bit discussed in the end of last lecture. that it was referred here that most often the architects and that kind of people who are used to modeling, and generally they have an architecture has a main role here. They like the idea of this kind of development, but those programming experts who like to write code and trust only code, like only code, they are against, and then there are some issues with middle management. Again, it relates in many kinds. We have referred to this also when we discussed about agile. It's referred in many cases when you bring some kind of new approach to the house. It changes if the shift is somewhat big in the organization and the whole development style. The role of middle management changes, and there are sometimes against of changes because they don't find a role in the new organization. Okay, to wrap this up briefly, like we started, these are the expected benefits when we speak about, okay, I used domain-specific modeling again, as the term here. We expect some cost savings, obviously, through automatic code generation. Those are the key issues. Then some side effects for quality. I don't know the side effects. These are crucial, one of the main things for automation. And generally, especially the reliability point. So when you automate, reuse, you confirm that automated core part of the system is with high quality, there is better chance that you get high quality software. So, because the computer doesn't do mistakes. If it does, it's in the core part. Yeah, it's enough to fix the bugs there. So you can understand it easily. If you do something 10 times, compare you have system to automatically generate the code, it does it the same way every time. And when you have someone doing that manually, you usually get more bugs. So some human mistakes always happen. So in this sense, the machine is more reliable. Of course, you have to ensure the quality of the generator, but the more you use it, the more you find bugs and correct in them. So the more you use the same core, the better the quality gets, and it's more reliable result than in manual programming. Okay, basic idea in automation. Then another thing here, I don't know what is smart from strategic point of view in each of the cases, but in theory it's possible, like it was here in Juha Pekka's picture. Wait a minute. Here in the left bar, when you do this kind of whole implementing domain-specific modeling language here, you have possibly the chance to get few best developers in-house, even in a big house. You can choose the absolute top experts in-house to do the domain-specific language and code generators. Okay, that's the other general reasoning for this quality. Okay, then again, communication, it hasn't discussed a lot and now with this. But that's one of the general ideas. If you do this kind of modeling-based development, and you have, you do the actual development with models. In the best case, you get final product based on that. It's easier to share that with non-technical people also. It's easier to discuss with customer, with management around some model compared to code. Or some more technical issues. So the more technical issues are hidden there in the generators and in the language definition. So that's the basic idea there. And then video architecture, it's okay, there are several reasonings for this, that the whole thing needs, that doesn't come for free and automatically, but the whole thing is based on architectural design to get the full benefits of it, this. You need to have smart architecture to define what to automate, what to not, and so on. And it kind of forces the good architecture. And again, the other side of the cost, we discussed about this already. I'm not gonna repeat this again. So we get forward here. Okay, now we forget domain-specific modeling. I wanted to repeat just some things about that to make that clear. I suppose that even this, Juha-Pekka gave a very good lecture on this, and you can listen again the details from last time. I think this is the most challenging part of the course. To get the picture of it based on just one lecture, it might be complex. Okay, some more general thinking on this. Like I said, reuse and automation is today the two big words. There has been different kind of reuse or automation also for long, long times in the field. It's even I've heard even in the 60s, in that time in programming languages, they had pretty big libraries for different subroutines. And then there has been discussion on components and such like things that in the 90s that was discussed a lot, how to share components in software, in let's say some big software house, how to enable reuse of software components in house. Of course, everybody in the 90s already used components provided by general tool providers and common components in the field generally, but if you have in-house development and how to share information about components in-house and how to enable effective reviews of those, okay, that has been studied a lot. Then product lines, it's been referred to this. Much of the thinking around this model-based development, which we have discussed, is about product lines. It's used for different purposes also, but the most common use of domain-specific modeling is, for example, product lines. Like last time examples, fish farms or those watches are product lines. Okay, then platforms sometimes mean a bit same thing. Then about this DevOps, you have some course readings on that. Again, automation is some keyword discussed around DevOps. But okay, the point was just that there are different terms and concepts in the field that speak more or less about the same things in our terms here, reuse and automation. Software product license one. This is nothing new. It's been done for a long time. There is a lot of research on this. For example, Software Engineering Institute in Carnegie Mellon University had a main role internationally here. Here, the same organization that has developed that CMM model we discussed when we had the process lecture. And this is their definition for software product lines. Software product line is a set of software-intensive systems that share a common managed set of features satisfying the specific needs of a particular market segment or mission, and that are developed from a common set of core assets in a prescribed way. Okay, that's complex explanation, but that's how they define it. So, just to show, you find this kind of statistics everywhere. When you read about any kind of new method approach in the field, we can have some similar doubts as any time. So some critical thinking here, but okay, for the same reasons we discussed just few minutes ago, it's believable that you gain some advantage if you do automation and reuse the smart way. This is again about that. Product lines, this doesn't mean a specific way technically to do that, but this is on more general level than model-based development we discussed earlier. There has been reported high productivity increases and such like things, as in any paper. Not go into any details with those. Then I just want to bring this concept in and as a term, this software product lines. You hear it in many occasions, and it relates to the topic today. Then they have, in Software Engineering Institute, they have a framework for this kind of product line development. It has a bit similar features as CMM, CMMI models, which we discussed in the process lecture. So the idea of the framework is to give some idea that if you would like to implement this kind of software product lines idea in your organization, which kind of practices you possibly want to think about. What kind of management you should have there? What kind of practices to develop this or that you need to have? So this is from their material, or this is from an article, but this pretty old, but this is the picture they use in all the material. It's often used related to the product lines. So this brings in the terminology. So when the discussion is about software product lines, they have a specific terminology which is based from that Software Engineering Institute material. So there is nothing special here, but they just use specific names for things, and you should be familiar with these when you read material in the field. So in some other contexts, there are different names for the same things. The basic idea is, like we discussed about model-driven development already, is that they call the core reusable part of the system as core asset. Then this product development here means development of a single application or product, whatever you call it. And then there is this management cycle, that's how to coordinate this all together. And Often it's suggested that you have different, in a large organization, that you have different teams for this. You have a different team to develop that core part of the system for reuse. And then you have different development teams for each project or product delivery, whatever you have. And then, again, you need some management practices to coordinate that all. Okay, that's pretty obvious. Okay, some examples. Like web development, I think this kind of ideas has been a lot used. There, let's say in the simple examples, you, I don't know if this even correct use of the terms product line, but you know, in Finland there is kotisivukone. How many have used kotisivukone? No, there are several similar kind of applications. You can easily do your own home pages for your organization, company, or in some services like that, you have some basic version of web store, which you can easily build just through some wizard in 10 minutes. You just select which color, which elements, and so on. You get the basic model of web store, including all the standard. Okay, it's so standard business there. Okay, in the more serious business in software houses, there are a lot of small web developers who do the same thing based on some platform. So the idea is that you get this much ready from the platform in some companies who do serious business in the field, add something on there. And you have this size of platform, and then you do some small adaptations for each customer. And that means the platform from some open source system or whatever, plus your own add-ons, are the core asset there. And then product development means that those adaptations or whatever you need to do for each customer. Okay, game industry, it's an obvious case for this. You have different, same games for different platforms. You have the same functional code, basically, but you need some adaptations for each platform. So you have the core part, and then something you adapt manually. Okay, one typical example everywhere around this is it was the Nokia old models of Nokia forms. They, based on this kind of thinking, they enabled the high number of different product models. Some 20 years ago, it was high step. Or HP printers have used this a long time, so it's easy to understand the idea. So there are so many similar features in each printer, but many different models that have some differences. And this fits well. Or in televisions, they have used this kind of thinking for software for long. Okay, a few viewpoints. I collected here from a few articles. This is the actual thing. When we discussed in this course about these issues, like in this lecture, I'm going to go through quickly a few different viewpoints that relate generally to reuse or automation. And so we can't go to the details in this course. We would need a whole course for software product lines or like I'm going to discuss very quickly something about test automation in the end of this lecture. So what we try to understand here, we can't understand the technical details there in each development method and so on. But you start to see that there are some similar questions when we look at this in more general, often management kind of level. The similar questions comes up again and again. Okay, some things about software product lines. I've collected here challenges or lessons learned, whichever they are called in different papers. A pretty old paper again from, by the way, just to mention, if you look for material in this field, this is a good example that it was pretty difficult to find some recent case study or any kind of scientific study that would discuss product lines on this kind of general level, because it already has 20 years of history, or maybe more than 20 years. It has been studied a lot. You find some good case studies from 20 years ago already, but then the interest of the researchers have evolved after that, and they focus on some small details in the field, like the different technical solutions to manage variation between different versions in software product line organizations or whatever. So, just that you know. So, that's why some of these are pretty old. You don't find this kind of, new this kind of stuff. So, that Kircher et al. Paper, few things and challenges they raised up in their implementation of software product lines in the organization. I don't explain now the backgrounds, I just go this through pretty quickly. Okay, agility was one thing. The question that, wait a minute, if you do this and we want to be agile at the same time, are these contradictory? We have to think about this. And obviously, there are some contradictions. You find several later papers on that. I found that pretty easily. Because then one main thing is this kind of balancing between quick development for to deliver the product, one single product, quickly to the customer, compared to the development of that those core assets, building architecture for that. That's one big discussion there. If you think about agility and product lines, there are some contradictory issues, but obviously you can do product line kind of development in many ways, agile way, iterative way. There are different strategic ways to build up product lines. It's not limited. Agile is not excluded, but there are some fundamental contradictory points. Okay, then one basic thing, skills. Hey, what kind of skills we needed? We need a bit new kind of skills. Driver in transition means that, okay, is this driven by developers, architects, management? Who are the actual drivers in the organization for that? Okay, then in that specific case, they were used to outsourcing for a bit cheaper labor costs, but then it kind of And then they try to gain the same kind of achievement and cost savings with automation and reuse with product lines and how that all fits in. Wait a minute, should we think again our outsourcing strategies, how the, we have built up practices, how we run projects in this outsourcing way. So if we do the transition to product lines, wait a minute, what changes in this whole system, communication? Can we still use outsourcing the same way, or should we drop it off, or how the practices should be changed on how we share the tasks and so on? Okay, tools, obviously, it raises up often in this kind of issues. You need proper tools, and it was a bit challenging in the case. Okay, some lessons from Cohen et al. I didn't gather all, but some points I picked here. In that case, they supported for iterative approach to deliver fast benefits. So there are different strategies to build up product lines. You can think you can do a huge upfront design for those core assets and use a lot of time and effort to do huge core assets part immediately. But often in these, it depends on the case and the strategy, but it's one strategy. Often in these papers when you read, I found they, if it's only possible, they support more a bit kind of agile of a small steps, iterative way. So if you have done all the projects manually, to keep it simple, let's do this small core asset part first to reuse and automate, and then step by step increase that. But that still needs strategy and rigorous approach, or otherwise you end up delivering that each product fast and dirty, and you never develop the core asset part properly. Now, okay, clear business goals. These kind of things are repeated in every organizational change things. Okay, a couple of more things here. Strict separation between domain and application. That was actually a couple of things there related to the same thing of the last paper. That means that in this model, in somewhat sized organization, if you follow the suggestions to have different teams for the core asset development and the application development for single products, based on that, that may cause some consequences. It's, by the way, one contradiction point between this kind of model and agile kind of thinking with things that we all work together, big happy family and so on. And let's, or if you read about DevOps, that's about integrating and cooperation as the same team all the time. In these suggestions, it's often suggested that you have separate teams to do the core asset part and then the single applications. And there were some trust issues. It was a lot of negotiation and some conflicts on what should be included in the core asset part, who decides what should be included in there, and so on. And some teams didn't trust in each other, and sounds like things they found in their case. Okay, their lessons, you have to measure the success of obvious management thing. And tools, again mentioned here, it's one thing in automation that is raised up everywhere. Okay, so this, the in this paper, this was a raised question more to the scientific community that we would. The authors stated that we would need more research on this. So, how to communicate with the management, the sales organization. So, this includes pretty much technical issues. Like here, we go this through really quickly. You don't understand much of the details, at least based on this lecture. You have to read a lot of more. But the same thing is, you have here a lot of possibilities, but you have some restrictions there. You must understand somewhat of the technology possibilities, restrictions, and so on to make trustworthy, reliable calculations of the total costs. And so they call for better ways to communicate with management, how to get the management understand what this is all about and how should we operate in this field. Okay, to wrap it up, so some general questions that comes to my mind. If we talk about, I try to look at this at more general level now, without going to the technical details. So we must understand what are the total costs. So technical solution is one thing. How much do we have to put effort to build that up? Of course, we must understand the cultural change. We need more abstract thinking, new kind of skills in the organization. We need a lot of communication. Also, of course, in the transition, we need a lot of planning and communication, how to build up the whole organization again. But in the actual development, if we have two different teams that have a bit different goal, if we have that in that model, the core asset team, they have their own goal to have a really fine core asset package. Then we have the development team that has their goal to deliver the product to the customer fast and fine enough. So there is a lot of communication needed that is not needed in that form in a more traditional way to do this. Okay, let's go forward from that. Okay, some general questions you want to possibly ask. If we do this kind of transition, take this kind of new star, how does it affect project management or other management practices, like it was referred to outsourcing? You have to possibly think it over again. If we have some agile practices already in the house, and then we try this kind of, oh, wait a minute, what we have to think again. So one big questions are, of course, those are more technical questions, what to reuse. So what is kind of the breaking point, what is beneficial to reuse? And what is not? That's obviously one big question for effective use of this kind of approach. So it's how to manage changes. That's for me would be one of the main questions. There are a lot of research on this, I'm sure. That the value, the more you get value in reuse and automation, the more you, so the more stable your core asset package platform, whatever you call it, is, the more you get value it. So the more often you can reuse the same core asset package, the more you get value of it, obviously. And then if you do some major changes in some single project, and you have to think about how it affects your product line. So the change management overall, it's a different question when you have product lines. Okay, what kind of new skills we need? These kind of questions, I'll repeat it. And okay, I forget the rest here. So we get to some other points to wrap up the whole lecture. Okay, this is one side note here. This doesn't relate actually to the topic of today. It's more about the agile in the early years. A bit old paper, but nice picture, and it's a nice story if you want to take a look. It's a good way to describe categorization of different products in the house or projects that fits. So the general story that fits to different kind of purposes. So the organization gave an example in the paper how they are in product business, how they categorize their different products. And the basic idea for the whole paper is that how they have defined different development practices for different kind of products. So cows there, for example, they named it as animals here. Cows are the products that bring most of the money in-house. They are mature, pretty old products already in the market. Big products bring more money and mature than bulls. There are, again, big products, but new products. They want to bring the market. They don't have the market share yet with the product, but they are trying to get there. And again, there are smaller products. And so the scale in the vertical scale is project uncertainty here. So that's what it means. So they have all mature products which they know the market. It's pretty certain they get, at least for now, sure money of the big cows. Bulls are more unsure, and they are new products. They are trying to find market for them, and so on. Then there are smaller products with similar kind of idea. So, but the basic idea is here, the context in which they wrote that was their agile kind of development, and in which and how they use agile principles in which categories of the products in product development. But the same kind of thinking fits to all development methods as well, which we have discussed here. You don't have to define only one way to do software in your organization. You may have many and way to handle the whole project or product portfolio. Okay, some words quickly in the end of test automation. Okay, as a starting point, I remind you of the quality lecture We discussed about software quality in general. And then we discussed that quality is much more than quality assurance. That it includes some certain activities. So then, again, testing is just a part of quality assurance activities. And again, when we speak about test automation, you cannot automate all kind of testing. But usually when you read the material in the field, it's that usually you combine automated tests and manual testing. But there is a high trend. Partly it relates possibly a high DevOps boom. I feel that the same time. So if you want to deliver software really fast and put it into operation really fast, you need high level of automation. That's what DevOps is focused on. And then you need also test automation there to keep it all together. But just reminder that it's just, in this kind of thinking, it's just more a small part of quality overall. That test automation, you cannot tackle all the questions with automating the tests. So okay, you have some obvious benefits with test automation. We're not going into details anymore now. But a few words about this. Limitations listed in that article I refer here. Here, it's reminded, as I said, you cannot replace manual testing. Usually you do both. Third and the fifth are a bit related. You may have some false expectations. If you expect that the whole quality is tackled if you just do some test automation, you're not going to get there. Or it may be that the costs for building up this are underestimated and so on. Difficulty of maintenance of test automation. So usually there are different kind of test automation. I don't go to the details. We would need a separate course for that. And that would go to pretty technical level. But there are different kind of test automation. Most common is called regression testing. You write text and tests, then manually most often, and then you can rerun the tests as many times as you want again. Okay, then there are different methods for test case generation automatically or test data generation and so on. But let's stay at general level. But this maintenance issue relates to that. If you have that manually written regression tests for your automation, if you dramatically change something in your code, you need to rewrite your tests. And what often happens when you read this kind of stuff, that if you just want to deliver the software fast and dirty, you forget the tests, and at some point there is some rigorous approaches needed. If you want to keep up maintaining also the tests and keep the whole thing together. The whole process of test automation needs time. If you implement it, it doesn't happen like this. And then there are different... The tools are not mentioned here, but usually it's somewhat... You need, if this is totally new, you need new tools, you need new kind of skills. You have to find out proper strategies. It's a lot of new things, how to pick up the right tools, how to pick up the right effective strategy for automating tests. What should we automate? What should we not? And so on. What are the actual implications of this all? A lot of new things, and many of this is related to that. Like this, it's referred here that when it's talk about test automation strategy, that in some cases they found out too late that they have wasted too much time in selecting wrong strategy in the beginning, and they had to rethink the whole system again later. Okay, we don't have time for this. Again, there are some general issues, general challenges. This is from some consultant agency, I think, not the research paper. And again, I don't go through DevOps, but I had one slide of DevOps. The main point here is that this is from some consulting agency. Again, there's some top 10 challenges with DevOps in the industry. But the main point is not there. Here. What I'm trying to say here in this lecture, when we can take a look at all this, when the keywords for this were reuse and automation, there are some common characteristics that repeat every time you do something like this. There were DevOps, test automation, product lines, domain-specific modeling. It all fits in here, more or less. So it means if you implement this kind of new practice, it means changes in the development process. So you possibly have to think, how does this affect project management? What kind of roles we should have in the organization? Does this affect customer relationship? How about outsourcing, agile practices, whatever we have already in the house? So it's not only the effects are not only the technical in the development, but may affect the whole process. When you do automation and reduce, the tools are important. It's a big question often to find the right tools and right ways to use the tools. You need expertise and that. And common to this all, it requires more abstract thinking. It repeats in all this. And when we talk about reuse, generally, automation, you cannot just do the delivery fast and dirty. There is more focus and good architecture to get good use of that whole reuse automation system we have in-house. Then the question you want to ask, what the kind of skills we need, possibly some new skills, possibly some expertise. Usually, at least in the implementation, you have to find the right tools and approaches in the beginning. You need a new kind of expertise to those. Role of architecture mentioned. And overall, when you read this kind of stuff, find that many challenges anyway are not technical. In these issues, there are more technical issues included than in agile adoption we discussed before in this course. But generally, there are many similar things. When you adopt a new method, a process, you do some organizational improvement. And so many issues are not technical anyway. You find the same, pretty much the same findings in case reports, no matter if it's about agile or or test automation, you need management support and such like general things. Okay, I'm going to end here, but one tip. Note here. So I didn't discuss about DevOps. I wasn't mentioned to. But you have a couple of papers related to that in your course readings. And if you didn't already, but in the first video lecture, you have very brief introduction to DevOps. So you possibly want to listen that before you get to the readings. My suggestion here. But that's all for today. Thanks.